Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going straight into the atomic architecture of high-performance steel. Our mission is to take this stack of very technical sources anchored by some foundational research out of Cambridge and really give you a shortcut to understanding one of the most crucial processes for making materials strong.
We're talking about the controlled decomposition of phases. It's a real deep dive into physical metallurgy.
Yeah.
Specifically, the diffusional decomposition of austenite into ferrite.
Right. The transformation of gamma to alpha.
Exactly. And this isn't just, you know, some academic curiosity. Understanding how alloying elements like tungsten, silicon, and titanium influence this whole process is the direct route to creating steels that are tough enough for the most demanding applications.
Okay, let's unpack that straight away, because those terms can sound like a mouthful. For you, the listener, the mission is pretty simple. We are learning how engineers basically bake tiny, perfectly placed reinforcing rods into steel, but at the atomic level.
That's a great way to put it. When we talk about strengthening these alloy steels, we're really talking about manipulating this exact phase transformation to create something called interphase precipitation.
Interphase precipitation.
And this process deposits a super fine, uniform dispersion of alloy carbides all throughout that new ferrite phase. That final microstructure dictates everything.
Everything meaning strength, ductility.
Strength, ductility, and a really critical property called hardenability.
And just to be clear, hardenability in this context doesn't mean how hard the steel already is, but more its capacity to resist the transformation.
Precisely. It's the material's resistance to change when you heat treat it. So a higher hardenability means the transformation kinetics are delayed.
Which gives you more control.
It gives you much more control over the final microstructure, and it lets you cool the steel more slowly while still, you know, achieving a very strong result.
Now, when this transformation happens, the ferrite, the alpha phase, it doesn't just form in a simple block. The resulting shape, the morphology, is complex. The sources seem to focus heavily on one specific structure, the grain boundary allotria morph. What is that exactly, and why is it so important?
Well, think of it like this. When you freeze water, the ice crystals usually start forming at the sides of the container first, right? At the boundaries.
Okay, sure.
Grain boundary allotria morphs are pretty much the metallurgical equivalent. They are crystals that nucleate preferentially at the high angle boundaries between the existing austenite grains.
Yeah.
Then they just spread out along those boundaries.
So they're the first thing to form.
They're the dominant starting morphology you see across wide ranges of temperatures and compositions.
So these allotria morphs are the initial structure, and as they grow, the steel gets its strength from this interphase precipitation mechanism. This seems to be the heart of it all. How does the interphase, the boundary between the old gamma phase and the new alpha phase, how does it manage to just drop off these perfect repeating sheets of carbide particles?
It's a truly dynamic process. You can think of the interphase as a tiny mobile factory. And the morphology of those carbide particles, whether they end up being planar or curved or irregular, that's entirely controlled by the structure and the mobility of that gamma alpha boundary.
Okay, let's get specific. The sources link these planar banded structures with a very particular crystallographic alignment and a specific mechanism.
Yes, the planar arrays, the straight ones, they predominate when the interface is semi-coherent.
Semi-coherent.
It means the crystal lattice of the austenite and the ferrite only partially line up. It creates what are called low energy facets.
Okay, semi-coherent is a key term. If they only partially line up, it sounds like there's a bit of, I don't know, friction or stickiness there.
That's a great analogy. Because the interface is semi-coherent and low energy, the growth doesn't happen smoothly across the whole face. Instead, the interface moves forward by these microscopic steps or ledges, which migrate across those facets.
And this is the ledge mechanism.
That is the ledge mechanism. The carbide particles nucleate on the flat surface, and then the entire structure moves forward as the ledges sweep across. It's what creates those perfect planar bands of precipitates.
But the sources don't stop there. They also describe a bowing mechanism, which creates curved sheets of precipitation. How is that fundamentally different from a migrating ledge?
Bowing happens when the carbide particles themselves act as strong initial anchors. Imagine a tiny dam holding back a stream. The particle literally pins the interface in place.
Okay.
Then, driven by the thermodynamic need to transform, the interface bulges or bows out between those pin points.
Ah, due to surface tension.
Exactly. It forms a curved structure. Eventually it breaks free, the cycle completes, and the process repeats, forming these curved sheets.
So we have a geometry problem. Ledges make straight lines, bowing makes curves. And the research suggests there's a specific physical parameter that dictates which mechanism takes over.
Correct. It all comes down to the spacing between those anchoring precipitates. The sources identify a theoretical minimum critical precipitate spacing. They call it a crit.
A crit, okay.
If the actual spacing of the carbides is larger than this critical value, meaning the anchors are far apart, there's enough room for the interface to bow significantly. You get an irregular dispersion.
But if they're packed closer together?
If the spacing is very small, less than a crit, the interface just can't bow effectively. And you get what they call a quasi-ledge mechanism, which forces the interface back toward that planar ordered growth.
It's just a stunning example of how nanoscale geometry dictates macroscopic material properties. We've established this incredible complexity, the ledges, the bowing, the critical spacing, which immediately makes me wonder, how on earth did researchers in the 1980s measure and analyze something so small and so fast? Let's get into the experimental precision this work required.
Well, the first step was some serious engineering choreography. The heat treatment. They had to austenitize the samples at very high temperatures, sometimes up to 1250 degrees Celsius.
And then drop the temperature instantly.
Instantly. Drop them to a specific isothermal transformation temperature, say 800 degrees, to start the reaction. This needed extremely fast quenching, which they achieved using fluidized beds.
These are tanks filled with rapidly circulating powders, right? Like aluminum oxide.
Exactly. Aluminum oxide, zirconium oxide. These fluidized beds allowed for almost instantaneous temperature shifts across the entire sample. And once the desired transformation time was up, the sample was immediately quenched again in water or iced brine.
Freezing the reaction in place.
It freezes the transformation mid-process. It lets them examine a snapshot of the developing microstructure.
So they've frozen the reaction. How do they then quantify how much of the material actually transformed?
That required some painstaking image analysis. They used specialized systems to scan and digitize the microstructure images, which let them discriminate between the phases based on their gray level.
So it's about contrast.
It's all about contrast. They were able to accurately determine the volume fraction of the ferrite phase, even implementing things like guard regions to eliminate statistical errors from the edges of the sample.
And for measuring the speed, the kinetics, they used a completely different setup, something involving changes in length.
That's isothermal dilatometry. They'd use these hollow, rod-shaped specimens and measure the instantaneous change in length over time.
Why length?
Because the transformation from austenite to ferrite involves a slight change in density, so the specimen's length changes just a tiny bit. This change was magnified up to 10,000 times by a high-speed dilatometer, giving them extremely precise, real-time data on the reaction speed.
That gives us the bulk numbers. But to actually see those planar carbides, to see the tiny ledges, you need the ultimate detail.
And that's where transmission electron microscopy, or TEM, comes in. They had to thin the metal foils down to just 0.05 millimeters.
So an electron beam can pass through it.
Exactly. That reveals the microstructural details on the nanoscale. It lets you capture diffraction patterns to identify the crystal structure of the carbides themselves.
And finally, to verify the chemical ingredients.
That was the job of microanalysis in a scanning electron microscope, and SEM. Using techniques like EDS and WDS, they could get both qualitative and quantitative compositional data.
So they could confirm, yes, that's a tungsten carbide particle.
Not just that, but how much tungsten, how much carbon. It's this whole suite of tools, from rapid quenching to nanoscale chemical analysis, that gave them the robust data they needed.
Let's get to the results then, because the behavior of just three alloying elements, silicon, tungsten, and titanium, tells a fascinating story about control. Let's start with silicon. They looked at a steel with tungsten, carbon, and about 2% silicon.
And silicon was a powerful accelerator. Compared to the non-silicon alloys, the transformation kinetics were just significantly faster. We're talking about getting the first 10% of transformation done in just 2 minutes at 800 degrees Celsius.
So why is silicon flooring the accelerator pedal here?
Well, thermodynamically, silicon acts in a couple of beneficial ways. First, it expands the stable region of the alpha phase field, which essentially makes it easier for ferrite to form in the first place.
It makes the conditions more favorable.
Right. And second, it's believed to decrease the solid solubility of carbides within the ferrite.
So if the ferrite can't dissolve the carbides,
it forces them to precipitate out immediately at the interface, which enhances that whole strengthening mechanism.
And structurally, the silicon alloy offered a major surprise, didn't it? It challenged some classical metallurgical ideas.
It really did. The sources showed that at the highest temperature they studied, 850 degrees Celsius, they saw both the low-energy facets and the ledges moving at the same time.
Which was not expected.
Not at all. The classical view was that these low-energy facets are essentially immobile during these diffusional transformations. But here, they were clearly moving. And what's more, the height of those moving ledges varied dramatically, by an order of magnitude. So silicon doesn't just speed things up, it makes the interface much more dynamic.
Dynamic and fast. Okay, now let's look at the element that slows things down. The high-carbon tungsten steel, this time with no silicon.
The transformation rate was markedly slower. For one, the high carbon content contracts the alpha phase field, making the transformation harder to start. But more importantly, we see this clear mechanism of pinning by tungsten carbide particles.
So as the interface starts to form, the tungsten carbides are like immovable roadblocks.
That's exactly it. They observe the gamma alpha interface developing these serrated or ragged protuberances because the growing ferrite was literally trying to push past these carbide anchors.
And that pinning action is what gives the steel increased hardenability.
Yes, the kinetics are physically delayed.
Now let's introduce titanium. They studied a similar tungsten steel, but with just a tiny amount, 0.14 weight percent of titanium added, and this was an even more dramatic retarder. Why is titanium so much more effective at this than tungsten?
Titanium has a critical advantage. It forms very stable titanium carbides, and these carbides preferentially precipitate first along the austenite grain boundaries.
Before the main transformation even begins?
Yes, before the austenite to ferrite transformation even really gets going.
So it's not just pinning the moving interface, it's suppressing the initial ignition.
Precisely. By forming these copious pre-precipitates on the grain boundaries, titanium dramatically reduces the number of favorable sites available for the ferrite to nucleate. It crushes the nucleation efficiency. And any ferrite that does manage to form still faces that pinning resistance. It's a double whammy of retardation.
So if titanium is such a powerhouse at increasing hardenability, why aren't all high-performance steels just loaded with it? What's the trade-off?
Well, the trade-off is often cost, but also control. You need extremely precise heat treatment to ensure those titanium carbides form exactly where you want them. If they become too large, they can actually lead to brittleness. This research is all about finding that sweet spot.
Just enough to suppress nucleation, but not so much it compromises the final properties.
You've got it.
Moving beyond the specific elements, let's tackle the theoretical debate that seems to still be a major topic in physical metallurgy. The models for growth kinetics. We're talking about NPLE versus PE.
Right. No partition local equilibrium or NPLE versus para-equilibrium or PE.
Yeah.
This is where the models clash. Both assume that the fast diffuser, carbon, is what controls the growth rate.
So how does the slow diffuser, the main alloying element, define the difference between them?
In NPLE, the substitutional alloying element, let's say chromium or nickel, does not partition between the two phases. It's essentially just incorporated as is.
Okay.
In PE, the element does partition, but only just enough to maintain a constant ratio with the iron across the interface. That kinetic constraint makes PE an inherently slower growth process than NPLE.
So if we can just measure the partitioning of those elements, we should know which model is operating. Did the microanalysis on those systems settle the debate?
Frustratingly, no. The bulk microanalysis showed practically zero evidence of any bulk partitioning of the chromium or nickel.
So they couldn't tell the difference.
They couldn't conclusively determine if the growth was PE or NPLE just from measuring the final composition. The difference is just too subtle to measure in the bulk.
So the distinction remains theoretical, and it depends on an incredibly small distance.
Exactly. The definitive theoretical distinction lies in the thickness of the diffusion zone, which they call delta-delta, right at the gamma-alpha interface. If that zone is incredibly thin, we're talking less than 10 angstroms, which is only a few atomic layers, para-equilibrium is believed to govern the process.
And if it's bigger?
If the zone exceeds 50 angstroms, then NPLE takes over.
We are talking about the difference between a few atoms and maybe 10 atoms controlling the entire growth mechanism. That's really the boundary between theory and measurement.
That is the monumental challenge. The whole transformation is fundamentally controlled by this interplay between interface structure, temperature, and the specific alloying elements you choose.
And we've established this clear opposition. Silicon is an accelerator, making the interface more dynamic, more mobile.
While titanium is a strong retarder, physically suppressing the nucleation sites and pinning the interface.
And we also learned that the reality of the transformation is messier than the models expected, that interface precipitation isn't just confined to static surfaces.
That's right. It can occur on those highly mobile ledges, which really challenges some of the classical views of diffusional transformation kinetics.
This research from 1986 gives us a profound appreciation for how much fundamental metallurgy relies on measurements at the very edge of what's physically possible. So let's end on that boundary. We know the key to settling that NPLE versus PE debate is measuring that diffusion zone, that delta-delta, which could be less than 10 angstroms. Now, given that traditional microscopy struggles to resolve features smaller than about 20 angstroms, how might future high-resolution techniques, maybe something like advanced atom probe tomography, finally overcome this hurdle? How can we get the experimental proof we need to truly predict how new alloys will behave?
That level of atomic resolution will finally bridge the gap between kinetic theory and material reality. And the search for that precision, as you say, always seems to boil down to measuring an interface that's thinner than just a few atoms.